better off. Hello, Amazing Avenue Audio listeners. Welcome to episode 5 of A Pod of Their Own. I am Allison McCaig. I am joined once again this week by Linda Surovich. Hello, Linda.
Hello, Allison.
And I am also joined this week by Kellyanne Healy, moderator at Amazing Avenue and guest host this week. Hello, Kellyanne.
Hello, Allison, and hello, Linda. Thank you for having me.
Fantastic. Kellyanne is La Roma Bella on Amazing Avenue, in case you guys don't know. She's moderator. So you've been outed now, Kellyanne. How do you feel about that?
I have mixed feelings about that. I won't lie.
Yep. So if you guys are listening, don't go after her.
I was going to say, because we've had some incidents the past few days with the breaking of the no politics rule, guys. Come on.
Stop doing that.
Stop doing that. That's the most rules. Broken rule by far.
But Kellyanne is our fantastic ruler and leader, along with Mets fan for decades, whose true identity will never be revealed on this podcast. Nope. Anyway, we are here this week to talk about all things Mets, and to also give a book review for you in the second half of the show, so stay tuned for that. But right now, we are going to talk about the Mets catching situation, which is the biggest story this week. The Mets, in case you have been living under a rock Mets-wise, the Mets have designated Travis d'Arnaud for assignment, not even a month into the season, well, a month into the season, thereabouts, which is somewhat, you know, surprising, but indicative of the fact that they basically bungled this entire catching situation. Linda wrote an entire piece about it. So, Linda, why don't you summarize for our lovely listeners how the Mets have screwed this entire thing up?
Well, how much time do you have? Because there's a lot going on here.
All night if you need it.
Well, let's start at the beginning with tendering d'Arnaud a contract, because it was iffy from the beginning. They decided to tender him a contract instead of Wilmer Flores. But you know what? Even that's fine if you wanted to give him another chance. Okay. I think it ended up costing them around $3.5 million. Like, okay, I get it. Even though Tim Britton wrote an article saying it takes catchers almost 2 years to come back. But if you wanted to give him a second chance, fine. But then they compounded the issue by then trading Kevin Plawecki, who, you know, is no all-star, but at least he's serviceable and healthy. Like, he's not bad for a backup catcher. So they traded him for pitching depth, and that pitching depth is now hurt with no timetable to return. And Walker Lockett. So then, fine. You get rid of Plawecki. Then you bring in Devin Mesoraco, who was okay last year. He worked well with DeGrom. Jake loved him, had nothing but good things to say about him. But then, and they kind of promised him a spot on the roster, but then they said, oh wait, no, you have to go to the minors. He didn't want to go to the minors. They refused to release him. So he retired instead, and then after that went down, it turned out d'Arnaud would not be ready for opening day after all, so now they'd had no backup catcher, and so then that's how the story of how Tomas Nito made the opening day roster.
Hooray.
And now Tomas Nito is back because they designated d'Arnaud for assignment, and Rene Rivera is around, but he's not on the 40-man, so a move would have to be made for him. But, you know, I get not wanting to give up on d'Arnaud. He was your prized piece in the R.A. Dickey trade years ago, but you could have had a better plan in place for if he wasn't ready, or you could have non-tendered him, and then if nobody picked him up, you could have signed him on a minor league contract.
Yep. It's, to me, the most, like, mind-boggling thing about all of this is, if you want to, like you said, Linda, if you want to tender d'Arnaud a contract, if you still believe in him, that's fine. I was firmly on the side of non-tendering, but, you know, there's an argument to be made for both sides. But the perplexing thing to me is, why would you trade Kevin Plawecki, like, so early? That's the thing.
And especially, Brody Van Wagenen said, like, we're keeping an eye on the catching situation. Like, he knew going in, that was going to be a position of need, and now it's still a position of need.
Yeah, it's, and like, they kind of kept both catchers into spring training, realized that Darno was probably behind his timeline that you thought he was going to be. Once you realized he wasn't going to be ready for the opening day roster, you could have recouped 75% of his salary if you had gotten rid of him before a certain point. I forget what the exact date was in spring training, but there's a cutoff where if you get rid of him before a certain point, you can recoup most of his salary back. So they could have kept Kevin Plucky and Darno until that point and basically made a decision. Is Darno going to be ready? If no, you can cut him, get his salary back. If yes, then you can trade Kevin Plucky at that point and probably get roughly the same shitty return that you got. Like, it's just, it, like, even though, like, a lot of people online were like, oh, it's not that big deal, it's just a backup catcher. It's like, but this is so emblematic of the way the Mets handle things. That's what makes me mad about it. It's like, it is the most Mets thing possible.
It really, really is. And just to, I guess, chime in, just in terms of positional depth, we have such, this year, like, great positional depth. At like first base, we have Dom Smith and Pete Alonso. Second base, we have Cano and McNeil, who runs around the field like a squirrel, literally. I had to throw a squirrel reference in there. I'm sorry. But to me, almost every single position player has a good amount of depth, and catcher is so obviously glaring in that equation there. And it's very frustrating.
It's been this way for years now. Like, when was the last time they had an everyday catcher that you were comfortable with? Mike Piazza, maybe?
Yeah,
Mike, exactly. I mean, Paul LaDuca had a good couple of years. So that was probably the last time, I would say.
Okay. I forgot about Paul. Sorry, Paul.
It's like, yeah, and I mean, I don't know. Like, I don't think... At least I didn't predict. I don't want to presume that no one did, but I didn't predict that Wilson Ramos would look so poorly defensively behind the plate. Like, I knew that he was not, you know, an elite defensive catcher, but I thought he would be, like, at least, you know, okay. He's been pretty bad. I don't think anyone could have predicted quite how bad he would be. But what we did know before the season started was that he was injury prone. We knew that he had a robust injury history. We know that Travis Darno has a robust injury history. So carrying those two as your primary catchers and without much of a contingency plan in place seems foolhardy to me. And it turns out that it was extremely foolhardy. And the Devin Mesoraco situation is just extremely frustrating because they've, like... This is not the way that you handle your players. This is not the way that you deal with personnel. Of course, they didn't, like, breach his contract. He didn't have an opt-out, so, you know, it is what it is. But they basically gave him an under-the-table promise that he'd be on the team. They told him one of the viable paths for him to make the team was if Travis Darno wasn't ready. Well, that's what came to pass, and they still chose Nito over him. And I think it's because they thought that Darno would only be gone for like a week or two, and they wanted the guy who was on the 40-man roster already, so they didn't have to burn a 40-man spot. But be forthcoming about that to the player, and they were not. And that's the reason they're in the situation they're in now. They screwed up twice. They traded their backup catcher, and then they pissed off the other one.
And just to, like, build up goodwill, too. Like, you forced a man to retire because you were mad he wouldn't go to the minors? Like... how else are you going to get free agents to come here if you're going to play hardball with these guys?
And he's really done Mesoraco, I think. Like,
yeah.
All the beats have been tweeting, like, don't expect Devin Mesoraco to be back. He is retired.
Yeah. Which is really frustrating.
Yep.
That must be a frustrating end to his career as well.
Yeah.
Yeah. Ugh. I can only imagine being him and sitting around watching this and being like, you know what, Mets?
Oh, I can imagine a few things that are going through his head right now.
You guys.
Oh,
and
yeah.
It's not good.
Yep. The things that he's saying to his TV are probably similar things that I say to my TV about the Mets on a daily basis. I mean, you know what?
I'll say it to them.
Tomas Nito's first at-bat was good. I'll give him that. He had a clutch double that added two insurance runs to their win on Sunday, which was pretty legit. But I think, you know, and he is a good defensive catcher. So, you know.
No, Sorry, Pete just struck out.
Ooh.
With the runner on second.
Oh, no.
Yikes. We are currently in the midst of a tie game as we record on Tuesday night, April 30th, which is shocking considering Jason Vargas was on the mound. And he gave us what I like to call a Jason Vargas quality start, which is, you know, 5 innings, 1 run. That's the best you can hope for. But, you know, Mets offense is dead again, apparently, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
Here we are. So, yeah, I mean, it's just, is the backup catcher the most vital person on the roster? No. Is it emblematic of the Mets, the way they've screwed this up so royally? Yes, absolutely. Like, I'm trying to give Brody Van Wagenen credit for the things he has done well, and he has done several things well. He's built a lot of good things on this team, but this has been his most glaring mistake so far, I would say.
And, like, having a catcher, a good catcher, can put you, like, miles ahead, because there aren't that many out there. So having a serviceable one can really help change the whole complexion of your team, because, you know, there aren't that many good quality depth catchers out there for the other teams. Maybe Rayo Muto is the top, Grandal, but other than that, it gets pretty thin.
Posey, but Posey's not having a good year.
No, and do they still put him at first, too?
Sometimes, I think?
I think so, yeah. I feel like he was at first base, like, not that long ago.
Yeah. And it's just frustrating that.
Well, and also what's annoying to me, too, is the Brewers are everything the Mets should have been. They should have gone after Kane. They should have at least asked what the Marlins were asking for Yelich. They should have gone harder after Grandal. They should have signed Gio Gonzalez. Like, just watching that series, it's like, these could have all been Mets if they had just tried.
I know. Oh, Lorenzo Kane. Like, I remember I wrote a piece for Amazing Avenue during that offseason about how the Mets should sign Lorenzo Kane, and people were, like, hemming and hawing about the 5th year of the contract. I'm like, literally, who cares? Literally, who cares? And, like, they're like, oh, center fielder skill set, it's gonna decline. When he robbed that home run from Todd Frazier, didn't quite look like it was declining very much, don't you think?
Oh, that was so frustrating. I'm pretty sure he killed them the whole series.
Yeah, he did,
I think.
Yeah,
he felt like he did.
And he was struggling going in, too. The whole Brewers offense was struggling going in, as was the Reds offense. You know, the Mets are extraordinary at fixing other teams, making other teams who were struggling look good.
Yep. We're the cure for what ails you.
Yep. We are the cure for what ails you, especially given our pitching situation right now, which is the other topic for discussion. You know, obviously Vargas was okay tonight and gave us a Jason Vargas quality start. Mats has been pretty good. He's actually been the ace of the staff. Go figure. Wheeler's been, you know, hit or miss more or less. Like, he's been good some days and not so good other days. Jacob deGrom and Noah Syndergaard have been, you know, not just mediocre, straight up bad. And it's, you know, a problem. Like, and it's part of a general trend across the league that is not unique to them. There are aces on other teams that are struggling in a similar way, and it's like, it makes you wonder what's wrong. Are these with Syndergaard and DeGrom, are they mechanical problems, or is it something to do with the baseball? And,
well,
you know,
was it Noah who said it'd be like, after his last start, he said it felt like ice cubes, or he said the ball was slippery or something, and which is what Justin Verlander said when he thought the balls were different, too. So it seems like this isn't the ball they're used to throwing.
Yep, that was Syndergaard, and he said after his last start, every time he gets handed a new baseball, it feels like an ice cube, meaning it's slippery, he can't get a grip on it. And it was funny, actually, this kind of flew under the radar. I'm surprised it didn't get more, like, press among the beat writers. Maybe it was just in Phillies world that this got a lot of press. During the Phillies series, when Syndergaard was pitching, Phillies, like, accused him of doctoring the baseball. They said they saw, like, a substance that he, like, was apparently using, and when they asked Syndergaard about it, he said, if I was doctoring the baseball, you'd think I'd still be throwing crappy 86-mile-an-hour sliders. And I was like, I mean, you know, well, can't really argue.
But, like, you know, it also makes you wonder, like, okay, yeah, Jake and Syndergaard are struggling, but for someone like Vargas, if there's something weird with the ball, like we all like to make fun of Vargas and hate on Vargas, but it, like for someone who relies on feel, that's really got to be hard for him.
Mm.
Yeah. And like, I don't know. I have this theory that about this that I'm currently in the process of researching and writing about for Amazing Avenue, and I'm going to try to put an article out this week about it. I have this theory that I think the juiced balls, I mean, okay, I keep calling them juiced balls like it's a foregone conclusion. It's not. We have data to indicate that the balls are different this year based on home run rates and drag coefficients, but we don't actually have conclusive evidence that the balls are different because we haven't actually looked at the baseballs. So keep an eye on that out for that. Our previous guest, Dr. Meredith Wills, will look into it, she has told us. So, and she's looking for baseballs, so PSA, give her baseballs so that she can do the science. But, you know, trends are showing that the ball seems more like the 2017 version of the ball. And I have this theory that I'm currently looking into that guys that are reliant on hard sliders and nasty off-speed stuff are going to be more affected by these different baseballs, by these slipperier baseballs. Guys like Josh Hader, for example, who we just saw in the Brewers series, an elite relief pitcher who relies mostly on his elite fastball, is not going to be as affected. And, you know, we saw he wasn't very affected at all.
No.
And Steven Matz, it fits with Steven Matz being the most effective starting pitcher on the Mets staff this year, because Steven Matz has reduced his slider usage considerably. All of the Mets are heavily reliant on that Warthen slider that they were all taught. That's a big part of their success. Steven Matz abandoned it for the most part because he was having issues with his health, and throwing the hard slider was harder on his elbow. So he cut down on his slider usage. And I think that because he throws fewer sliders than the rest of the Mets staff, that's why he's been the most effective Mets pitcher this year. To me, it makes total sense. And it explains a lot of Jeremy's Familia's struggles, too. If it's really the baseball and it's really sliders that are primarily affected, Jeremy's Familia relies a lot on his slider. So that's just the theory that I'm testing out right now. Walks are up across the league as well. Hit by pitches are up. You know, we've seen it already. So many hit by pitches, so many walks. Pitchers are struggling so much to control their stuff, especially their off-speed stuff. Sliders are getting massacred across the league. They're getting hit very, very hard league-wide. So this is just, these are just trends. I have no conclusive evidence to draw serious conclusions. I can't say for certain that's the problem. And even if it is part of it, it's probably not the whole thing. It's probably only part of it. But I think there's something there.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I think so, too. Like, if it was just a couple pitchers struggling, okay. But since it's everyone, like, come on. The evidence is there.
Yeah. Like, you mean to tell me that Aaron Nola, Noah Syndergaard, Jacob deGrom, Corey Kluber, Chris Sale, Max Scherzer, all of these guys just forgot how to pitch at once?
I mean, it's possible. Maybe it's like it's our own Space Jam. The Monstars all took their talent. There's some planet somewhere that took their talent.
Could be. Pitcher's talent is being sucked out of them. And it's because of slippery baseballs and monsters. Combination. So that is our general Mets segment for this week. When we get back, we will go into our baseball segment, and we have a really cool book review this week, which is why Kellyanne is here. So stay tuned. When we get back, we'll talk about Infinite Baseball with Kellyanne.
Hello, I'm Spencer Hall from SB Nation, and I want to tell you about my new show, It Seems Smart. It Seems Smart is a show about people doing things that, for some reason or another, seem smart at the time. Those things might include doing a little cocaine and driving a bike up a mountain. Or, I don't know, maybe racing 100 miles per hour across the country in the middle of the night with no one's permission. Or even stealing a bat from an umpire's room in a Major League Baseball park. Check it out, and if you like it, tell a friend. I'm Spencer Hall. Don't do anything smart.
Hey everybody, I'm Neil I. Patel, editor-in-chief of The Verge, and this is The Vergecast. Vergecast is the flagship podcast of The Verge. Every week, we cover the latest in tech news and reviews. We take a critical look at what is going on now and next in the world of tech. The show is hosted by me, our executive editor, Dieter Bohn.
Not your friend.
And Paul Miller.
It just feels like there's something wrong with all computers, though. Don't you think that sometimes?
We do that on Fridays. And on Tuesdays, we have an interview episode. I've been talking to all kinds of influential people in and around the world of tech. We talked to Microsoft founder Bill Gates about his philanthropic efforts.
You can design systems without having to reveal any individual's particular medical record.
Journalists and academics like Lena Khan, who thinks that we should be doing way more to break up giant companies like Amazon and Facebook.
I think in hindsight, allowing Facebook to buy up both WhatsApp and Instagram proved to have been the wrong call.
And we talked to tech CEOs like Vizio's Bill Baxter, who explained exactly how smart TV manufacturers make their money.
It's about post-purchase monetization of the TV.
It's ads.
Check us out every Friday to hear about everything in tech, from new iPhone leaks to breaking down Facebook's ongoing issues of privacy to just me and Paul ranting at each other about the role of the government. And check us out on Tuesdays when I host the interview episode. Subscribe to The Vergecast wherever podcasts are served. We'll see you then.
All right. And we are back. So Kellyanne Healy, you recently read the book Infinite Baseball, which was written by a philosopher and Mets fan. About sort of the intersection of philosophy and baseball, and it's sort of, you know, little essays and vignettes. So give us a quick, you know, gestalt of how you feel about the book and what your thoughts were about it.
Well, firstly, this book kind of came into my life at quite the perfect time, just because I was high on baseball. The Mets weren't quite flailing about as they are right now. But this is kind of an intersection of both like the emotional, sentimental side of baseball with the more intellectual, philosophical side of it. And these essays are, they cover a sadly finite range of topics. But they talk about pace of play and just kind of the advanced stats and the how we view PEDs. The social media aspect of baseball and how that's evolved. And he is also a Mets fan. And so, of course, he has Mets perspectives as well, which is fantastic, I think. Some of the essays just that really stood out to me. Firstly, the one on pace of play, because we know how relevant that is nowadays with what MLB is trying to do to quote unquote speed up the game, which let's be honest, it's kind of made the game longer in my perspective. Mm-hmm. I don't know what your thoughts are on that, but that is my perspective. And then what are some other things that I liked? I'm paging through the book as I talk, because I have so many little tabs. I should take a picture and send it to you, Allison, so you can post it on your Twitter.
of all the tabs that are sticking out of your book?
Right now, I don't know where to start, because I really loved this book.
What made him a Mets fan? Does he say?
I'm sorry?
Did he say how he became a Mets fan?
I believe he didn't specify it in the book, but he did talk about it in the LA Review of Books interview that he did. And he became a Mets fan in the early 70s, back when the Mets had, you know, just won the World Series. And his parents were not Mets fans, so he kind of came into it on his own.
He made the choice, huh?
Choice. It wasn't an inherited fandom. Like, both of my parents were Mets fans.
I related a lot to what he said about his, like, Mets fan origin story, because he talked a lot about how the Yankees were associated with sort of, like, the, like, the, like, upstate elites and, like, very corporate style of baseball, and the Mets were, like, you know, the team for the real, like, down and dirty city kids. And I was like, hell yeah, like, Mets are blue collar, like, that's what I, you know, I so related to that,
and it's still pretty true now too.
It really is, and I agree with that, because I have friends who are very snobby, and of course they're Yankees fans.
Oh, you can always tell a Yankees fan.
and it's funny because my best friend is a Yankees fan and I love her to death, but she is a more casual baseball fan. She's like, yeah, I don't really follow what's going on with my team right now. And I'm just like, but it's baseball.
She probably wouldn't know most of the people that are in their starting lineup right now, unfortunately, for them.
Oh my God, with how injured they are. Oh my goodness.
Yeah, good Lord. But as a scientist reading this book, or like looking at the summary of this book, rather, I haven't read it, unfortunately, but I'm going to get to it. But like reading about what this book is all about, as a scientist, I found it fascinating because I kind of like during my like time at Hopkins, I've like delved between two worlds because I am very much a scientist who thinks about things like a scientist. But because I did part of my thesis on a bioethical project, I worked with a lot of ethicists and philosophers. So I like, you know, got to learn their perspective as well. And I found his discussion of, you know, the tension between the like analytics coming up in baseball and like his philosophy mindset and, you know, the parts of baseball that are about philosophy and emotions and like feelings as a fan, how that tension works with like analytics and always wanting to be logical and facts and, you know, trying to like reconcile those two things. So can you talk a little bit about how in the book he like touches on that?
One of the big things he talks about is baseball as a forensic sport, and just putting a context to everything. Like when we're so emotional, we kind of choose to blame a player themselves when it's not necessarily their fault. And I know I've done it. I say things in the moment where I blame a player and it's really not their fault for what's happening on the field. Something else is behind it. So really it's about putting a context into each action. Like we have RBIs, but an individual player really isn't responsible for an RBI because someone has to be on base to score for the player at bat to get that RBI. Do you if that makes sense.
Yeah.
And just a pitcher error. If a pitcher throws a wild pitch, that is his fault. But if a pitcher throws a pitch and the catcher, for whatever reason, doesn't catch it, it's no longer the pitcher's responsibility, that pitch and that error. So really kind of looking at it at a very intellectual perspective, and let me see my notes. What did I have written here?
Well, I also thought it was interesting, well, at least in the interview that I read, again, the same one that Allison mentioned, was that it's kind of like a whodunit. Like, baseball is a whodunit because we're always looking to assign blame to someone. Like, oh, why didn't that pitcher make a better pitch? Or why did the baseball more? Why did Frazier swing and just hit a home run? Which he did. Or, like, why did they screw up that play? Like, we all, like, we're always looking to blame someone in baseball, but that also puts a kind of a human element on it too.
It does. And if I can like just read this like short paragraph from this is from the essay The Forensic Sport, and this paragraph is just talking about earned runs and unearned runs, and it goes, consider runs are either earned or unearned. The ball that got away from the catcher and allowed a runner to advance a base, it is either a wild pitch and it is the pitcher's fault, or it is a passed ball, which is the catcher's mistake. Did that runner steal the base, or did he take it thanks to defensive indifference? Some pitches are strikes and others are balls. That is, some pitches are pitches that the batter ought to be able to hit. He's to blame if he fails to do so. And some are just lousy throws for which the pitcher is liable. So again, this kind of, a lot of it sometimes is a very human subjective element to it. And that also ties into a later essay where he talks about umpiring, the human umpiring, how we always complain, how the human umpires don't make the right calls and we need robot umps. But he made the case that convinced me that we don't need robot umpires, which is a little surprising. I wasn't expecting to feel that way after I read that essay. And that essay, I can't remember the title of it. Let me look.
Yeah, that was interesting.
So what's his argument? Yeah.
Yeah.
That was interesting because he did touch on that briefly in the interview as well, how like baseball is so much more a judgment sport than other sports.
Yes.
He referenced in the rules how the word judgment comes up 62 times in the official rules of Major League Baseball. But for example, in the NBA, it only comes up 6 times, and in the NFL, or 5 times in the NBA and 6 times in the NFL. So it's interesting because umpires are given so much more discretion in baseball, and we now have, you know, replay review in baseball, which came after the other major sports got replay review. But, you know, it's interesting how it's still umpires judging other umpires ultimately. And you know, it's still imperfect. They don't have the way that they have, I'm thinking about soccer now, the way that they introduce the video replay in soccer, how whether a goal is a goal or not. And they actually have the technology that shows where the line is, and they show where the ball is, and you're actually be able, like, you make a, like, an objective determination about that. Whereas in baseball, it's a lot harder to do things like that. You do have the strike zone that ESPN will show you during the game, the little box, whether a ball is a strike, whether a pitch is a strike or a ball. But you can't.
That's not necessarily the umpire strike zone.
Exactly. Yeah. And you can't challenge that. So that's always going to be a judgment call. And I don't know, in heats of passion, when an umpire gets a ball strike call extremely wrong in a key part of the Mets game, I am liable to say, God damn it, we need robot umps. But, like, I don't think I actually mean it. I don't know. I don't think I want them. I don't want
them. When I went to Cooperstown, I heard, I think his name was Al Clark. He was a former umpire. He led a talk. And, the perfect game came up. Who was the one who lost the perfect game on the blown call? And somebody asked him about that. And he said a perfect game means literally everything has to be perfect, including the umpiring. So he was like, so it was an imperfect game because the umpire wasn't perfect that day. And that's just how it goes, basically. Mm-hmm. And that's the human element in the game.
Yeah, and people talk a lot about, you know, how Santana's no-hitter is tainted because of the blown call on the ball down the line. I never felt that way. I never felt like it was less of a no-hitter because the umpire blew one call. It's the way the rules were at the time.
And it's the way the umpire called it, too.
Yeah, just like the perfect game. It's the way the umpire called it. It is what it is.
And that essay that he discusses that is aptly titled, Nobody's Perfect.
Nobody's Nerfect.
I love that title.
Had to sneak in the Good Place reference, the official show of Amazing Avenue Sack.
I mean, and I think honestly, probably my favorite section of the book was the last section, which talked about his like personal baseball memories and kind of talking about the more recent memorable Mets moments, like Wilmer Flores crying on the field because Twitter completely dropped the ball on him being traded. Talking about Matt Harvey too. And just the magic of the baseball field. And actually, he introduced something that I had never heard of before this, which is really cool. Something called Beep Baseball, which is basically the baseball game adjusted and adapted for those that are visually impaired, which is really cool. So,
oh, wow, that is cool.
I definitely recommend that essay when you read this book.
So another thing he talks about, and this is such like a philosopher thing, but it did get me thinking, is the concept of, and obviously he talks about a lot about how he loves baseball, and that's what unites us all, like all of us that listen to this podcast, all of us that are talking on this podcast, we all love baseball. And he talks about how, is something special because we love it, or do we love it because it's special? And that's, like, an interesting question. Like, is baseball just special to us because we love it, or isn't it an objectively special thing that we love?
Yeah, and I think he compared it to Tolstoy. Like, everybody's unhappy in their own way. Like, happy families are all the same, but everybody's unhappy in their own way. So, like, like, if it's different, it makes it special, kind of.
I would take the position that it's actually both. There are so many unique aspects to baseball that you don't find in any other sport. I mean, you can talk about how each sport has its own unique aspect, but baseball really seems to have so many quirks that you don't see in other sports, like triple plays or the really ridiculous plays that are kind of like freak plays that don't usually happen, but the possibility of them happening is there. And but on the flip side, of course it's special because we love it and we make it what it is by showing our emotion and writing all of these wonderful pieces and articles on Amazon Avenue are, of course, my personal favorite, just to be a little biased there. But I mean, we've had so many great baseball writings. I mean, just the wealth of books coming out this year and next year we had Ron Darling's new book, 108 Stitches, Art Chomsky's new book, I think, is coming out this summer, if it's not out already. Yes. I'm not 100% sure. And then, of course, Anthony DiComo and David Wright's book next fall. So, and that's just contained within the Mets world. I mean, we obviously cannot go without mentioning Roger Angel and A. Bartlett Giamatti and their baseball writings, which are just, I have no words. I just have sounds for them because I love their writing jealousy so much. I wish I was that good of a writer. So again, I think it's just a bit of both. I think the sport is objectively special, and I think that we also make it special. So those are my thoughts.
I completely agree, Kellyanne. And I think that that's a perfect note to end our book review segment on. Baseball is both objectively special, and it's made even more special because we love it. So now we're going to move on to our segment that we close out the show with every week that we like to call Walk-Off Wins, where each of us talks about what's making us happy this week. So Kellyanne, let's start with you. What is your walk-off win?
Oh, my walk-off win is, well, we'll start with the in-the-moment one that happens right now, and that is that the Mets have taken the lead again. Yay!
It is
this game. But my actual planned walk-off win is just my story time, kids. I probably have mentioned it within the comments on Amazing Avenue before, but I work in a library. I am a storyteller, and I work with early childhood. And my kids that I work with are just fantastic every week. They make me so happy. They learn so much. They do the songs with me. They share with each other. I can't get over how kind they are to each other at this age. And yes, that's what makes me happy. And that's my walk-off win this week.
Yay. And I mean, we've mentioned many times on this podcast how Amazing Avenue seems to have a concentration of librarians and people who work in libraries. And Kellyanne is one of them. And Linda is also one. So I'm talking about books with two book nerds right now, which is a blessing.
Oh, yeah.
So Linda, what is your walk-off win for this week?
Okay, my walk-off win is I had to go see Avengers because I was too afraid of spoilers, so I had to go and I had to see it before the whole movie got spoiled. And it was amazing. It was everything I hoped it would be. But there was a point when they played the Captain America theme and I started to cry because it reminded me of David Wright walking off the field.
Oh my God.
That song is forever ruined now because I can't hear that song without thinking of David Wright walking off the field. But as a whole, the movie was good. And there was, I can't say too much and it's driving me crazy. But there was an awesome moment for Captain Marvel that got a good reaction from the crowd, but made me very happy because I love that she's badass. And Citi Field was shown. And yeah, I'll just sleep with that. There was the Mets aren't doing too good.
No,
they have been, for lack of a better word, Thanos. Is that how you pronounce that name? I'm not a Marvel junkie or fan.
Yes.
Oh, boy.
Thanos wasn't kind to the Mets. We'll just put it that way.
That's unfortunate.
Yeah. But yeah, the movie made me happy despite... you will cry. You'll need tissues, including if you're a Met fan and if you're emotional about David Wright like I am. But overall, the movie was good and I was happy I saw it.
Yeah. No spoilers. So, but maybe we will revisit Endgame during another walk-off win during another week far in the future when when most reasonable people who would have been mad about spoilers will have seen it already. And then Linda, you can revisit it and talk all about the details.
Okay.
So my walk-off win for this week, for those of you who haven't listened to previous episodes of the show, those of you who have do know that I recently finished my PhD at Johns Hopkins in human genetics, which was a huge accomplishment for me. It was 5.5 years of hard, hard work. But the way it works in my program is that once you defend your thesis, which I did in February, you get kind of 3 months after you defend to officially like hand in your dissertation, all your paperwork, and like be out the door. So for me, that deadline is now May 15th. And this week, I officially finished my dissertation. It is done. The entire thing is written. And that feeling is my walk-off win for this week because, you know, the act of writing that was, you know, such a labor. And it's all of the work that you put in over your entire PhD all in one document. And it's blood, sweat, and tears over the past 5.5 years in one 140-page document that I wrote. And it's, you know, no one's ever going to read it. So that's not what motivates me. But looking at it, it's not physically bound yet. But once it is, it will be really nice to have just like that physical representation of everything I put into this over the past 5.5 years. So it was really cool to, you know, type that period on the very last sentence of the very last chapter of my dissertation. So that was a really good feeling and a weight off my shoulders. So that is my walk-off win for this week, finishing my PhD dissertation.
Well, congratulations. It's a lot of work and it's very impressive too.
Thanks. Yes. I had several drinks.
Dr. McKing.
Yep.
Sorry, that was my little musical moment there.
I'm a doctor.
I want to read your thesis.
Yo, you won't understand
I was going to read it. Well, I want to read it. How's that sound?
Okay. I will give it to you. I can't promise that you'll understand all of it because Lord knows anybody outside of my very small field won't understand it. But yeah, I will definitely pass it along to you if you're interested in reading it.
And also, you're leaps and bounds ahead of Chidi, too.
It's true. Chidi will never finish.
No, poor Chidi.
Poor Chidi.
So many Good Place references.
That's 2 Good Place references. We're on a roll. Excellent. So
that is forking awesome.
That is forking awesome. I should probably learn to use the Good Place version of cursing more often on these shows so that they can be family friendly, but still feel the satisfaction of cursing at the same time and get a Good Place reference in along with it. Win-win situation. So those are our walk-off wins for this week. Before we close out completely, I just want to give you guys a quick reminder that we are running a giveaway right now that we first announced during last week's show. So in order to be eligible for this DeGrom Cy Young bobblehead that Maggie has, follow A Pod of Their Own on Twitter and tweet us a screen cap of your iTunes review by May 7th, next Tuesday, for a chance to win the DeGrom Cy Young bobblehead. So follow A Pod of Their Own on Twitter, tweet us a screenshot of your iTunes review, and then you will be eligible to win a fantastic DeGrom bobblehead. Hooray! So that does it for the 5th episode of A Pod of Their Own. Please go to amazonavenue.com to read all of our other fantastic content. We mentioned Linda's piece earlier in the show about the Mets catching situation. Maggie Wiggin, our other fantastic co-host, who's taking time off this week to celebrate her birthday. Happy birthday, Maggie. She wrote a fantastic piece about Edwin Diaz and how he is everything the Mets traded for. And there is all sorts of other fantastic content, game recaps, etc. So go to AmazingAvenue.com to get all of that. Follow Amazing Avenue on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram at Amazing Avenue. Follow the show at A Pod of Their Own. You can follow me. I am at Petite PhD. Linda, where are you?
at Linda Cerevich.
And Kellyanne, you can find Kellyanne on Goodreads. Kellyanne, what is your Goodreads? Like, do Goodreads even have handles? Where can they find you?
Handles. It's going to, I guess, be a link tomorrow in the post.
Yes.
And I don't actually, just going backwards for a second, I don't think we actually mentioned the title and the author of the book that I reviewed. It is Infinite Baseball by Alpha Noy. I am hoping I pronounced that last name correctly, because he does mention that his last name is quite often mispronounced. So I apologize if it has been mispronounced, but yes.
And can that be found on your Goodreads?
Yes, it is on my Goodreads. And I will have probably a full review up within the next week or so, I would say.
We will link Kellyanne's Goodreads in the show notes, and we will also link the Goodreads link to Infinite Baseball and the interview for the LA Book Review that we all read prior to the show. So we will link those things for you guys to get you access to the book, connect you to Kellyanne on the social media that she has now. She has Twitter, but I'm not telling you what her Twitter is, because she's decided to delete Twitter because she's smarter than all of us.
Yep.
So you can find Kellyanne on Goodreads. You can find Linda and I on Twitter. You can find Amazing Avenue on Twitter. You can find A Pod of Their Own on Twitter. The original music for the intro and outro to this show is by Bunga. And let's go Mets. And don't forget, there is no crying in podcasting. Catch you next week.
My name is Spencer Hall.
My name is Jason Kirk.
My name is Ryan Nanny.
And when we combine, we form
the Shutdown Fullcast.
Voltron!
I keep telling you, we're not Voltron.
The Shutdown Fullcast is technically a college football podcast, but it's also a show about
lawn care disasters,
regional grocery stores we love,
Tennessee Batman,
homeowners associations,
Bears and video games,
Pittsburgh Batman,
the hell of being trapped in a group text,
unreliable legal advice.
I mean, there's also some actual football discussion, like about coaches having huge contracts, or coaches making terrible decisions, or coaches saying really stupid things.
Or the NCAA saying really stupid things.
Yeah, there's lots of stupid things in this big, dumb, beautiful sport.
Like the time Arkansas decided to use a captured feral hog as a mascot, and it escaped and it wound up killing 7 rattlesnakes, a pig, and a coyote.
Sometimes we talk about football games.
Allegedly.
If you want to take college football exactly as seriously as it deserves to be taken, come find us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever else you listen to podcasts like this one.
The Shutdown Fullcast.
It's not Voltron.
Unless it is.
Damn it.